Good. Okay, so we this week this is an exciting shiur. We're going to talk. Hopefully, we have a lot to cover. We'll see much what we do. Shmuel Bet Parak Yud Chet, the death of Avshalom. We're definitely not going to get to the end of the parak. We'll see how much we get to. My hope is that we can cover up until the death of Avshalom, and really have some time for a bit of a retrospective about his whole rebellion. When we next learn. And a week from now, that'll be exciting because then I'll be in we'll be in Skokie Yeshiva. So they have lots of empty classrooms, so I do not need to hunt random offices or music rooms. But so next week we're going to focus on David's reaction to the death of Avshalom. But that's not going to be for this week. This week we'll just focus on the end of the rebellion and what we can think about Avshalom himself. So to begin, we'll open the screen share. We have to begin with the end of the previous parak, because there's a very important point that Chazal draw out, which we'll see is going to kind of build up a bit of a theme at the beginning of the parak. And it's a classic example of the methodology of Medrash that Chazal so often employ. We were told that as David escaped Midbar Yehuda, right, thanks to the advice of Hushai Ha'arki. So Hushai Ha'arki did two very important things. Number one, he successfully countermanded Achitophel's advice. And so Absalom took his time gathering a large army rather than allow Achitophel to strike out immediately. But at the same time, because of his caution, Hushai sent word to David that he still should get to the other side of the Jordan River right away. And that is what David did. It was already by the next day. David crossed over the Jordan that night. He gets to Machanaim, which I put the map here, we can see Machanaim, the former capital city of Ishbosheth, now apparently seems to be a place where there is support for David. And the Navi told us that three significant people came bringing supplies, and they were Shovi ben Nachash Merabah ben Amon, Machir ben Amiel Milodavar, who Barzillai HaGiladi Meiroglim. The first two of these three people, we know who they are. The third one, we do not. And these two people, Shovi ben Nachash and Machir ben Amiel, it is surprising that they're on this list, but also very important. They bring immense supplies. They bring bedding and food, which apparently the people needed desperately. And if we look at the map, we can see where they're coming from, right? It's like a triangle. So Lo Davar, we know where that is. That's up over here. Rabat ben Amon, we certainly know where that is. So that's the modern Jordanian city of Amman. And they suggest that the third city, what was it? Raglaim, Roglim is over here. So everyone is coming in the middle to Machanaim, bringing supplies to David. Now, what we know about Machir ben Amiel, we met him much earlier in Shmuel Beis. He was the person who was sheltering or hiding Mephibosheth, the son of Yonasan. And after the end of Ishbosheth's kingdom, so remember when David finally had the chance, he had the chance to breathe for 3 seconds after the Plishtim had stopped attacking him. So the first thing he does when he has a minute, he says, "Where are there any surviving members of Yonasan's family?" And he's told that Mephibosheth has been concealed by Machir ben Amiel in the city of Lo Davar. So this was somebody who apparently was a real partisan for Shaul, a real diehard member of the Shaul Ishbosheth family. And yet we see the degree to which he has now come over to David's side. He is now bringing supplies to David HaMelech. Right? So that's just, it's an important note. In this time of civil war, we see some of the shoots of unity as well, right? Unity and support for David from surprising places with the arrival of Machir ben Amiel. That is one of the factors, maybe. And we're going to see this, by the way, this is kind of a theme. It's going to be in Parak Yud Chet, is the shoots of unity that the Navi kind of hints to us, even as we see so much civil war and destruction going on. Now, this other person, Shovi ben Nachash. So, who exactly is Shovi ben Nachash? Me'er bat b'nei Amon. Well, we know who Nachash was. Nachash was the king of Ammon. So presumably, Shovi ben Nachash is the son of the king, is the son of Nachash. Now, we met a different son of Nahash. We met Hanun ben Nahash in the beginning of the, you know, the prelude to the Bathsheba and Uriah story, when David sent the peace delegation after Nahash died and David wanted to pay a debt of gratitude, and Chazal explained the gratitude was because Nahash had sheltered the one surviving brother that David had. It's very likely Nahash didn't do that out of gratitude or friendliness to David, but out of resentment towards Shaul, because Shaul's first great moment was his war against, his defensive war against Nahash. Be that as it may, David sent the peace delegation to Hanun, the son of Nahash, the new king. Hanun's advisors tell him that this is likely just a spying operation. So Hanun humiliates them, cuts off half their beard, cuts off half their clothes, sends them back. That starts off a whole war, which ended with the conquest of the city of Rabat B'nai Amon. So the pshat, probably, in the pasuk over here, is that after the destruction of Rabat B'nai Amon, or the capture of Rabat B'nai Amon, Hanun is deposed, either killed or imprisoned, and his brother Nahash, his brother Shovi, sorry, is installed as the king instead. And that's the new king Shovi, the brother, the younger brother of Nahash, the younger brother of Hanun, who now is a David supporter and brings him supplies. And that would be surprising enough for, you know, the conqueror of my people and the conqueror of my city. And let's remember, David treated the Ammonim very harshly. He put them to labor after the conquest of the city. It would be surprising enough for him to be very, very loyal to David, but it could be. Right, that is definitely what the like the Dat Mikra says, that this is the pshat in who this person is. We know that there are going to be some favorable relations down the road, because David will marry Shlomo off to Naama HaAmonis. The pshat is that Naama HaAmonis is the princess of Ammon, so she's probably the daughter, almost definitely the daughter of this Shovi ben Nahash, the person who now is the king of Ammon. His daughter marries Shlomo. This is going to be during David's lifetime, because from the dates we know that Rechavam is 41 when he becomes king, and Shlomo was king for 40 years. So we know that Rechavam was born while David was still alive, and that means that Shlomo was obviously married while David was still alive. There's a Gemara that has Rechavam on David's lap. So we have the Shovi ben Nahash. There are good relations between him and David. That's a little bit surprising, but you know, it's also, once again, fits a pattern of support maybe coming from unintended or surprising places. But Rashi quotes from Chazal, who take things to the next level, and we should appreciate where this is coming from. Rashi just says about Shovi ben Nahash, who Hanun ben Nahash. So Rashi says that this mysterious Shovi, right, he's not the brother of Hanun at all. This was the original King Hanun himself, right? Which is where exactly is that coming from? What are the hints in the psukim? You know, as the Dat Mikra says, this is not the thing you'd normally expect. You'd expect when the king disgraces your ambassadors and there's a brutal war at the end, a king is not going to remain king anymore. You install someone else. You know, think, for example, when at the end of the Bayis Rishon, Yehoiakim rebels against Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar conquers Yerushalayim, takes away Yehoiakim. He's not allowed to be king anymore. His son Yehoiachin is installed instead. Nebuchadnezzar thinks that's actually a bad idea. He goes and installs the king's brother. He installs Tzidkio when Yoshio is killed. So the people install Yehoahaz as king, and the Mitzrayim come back and they say, you know, we're not interested in Yehoahaz being king. We're going to depose him and we're going to install his brother instead. That's part of the course, is installing the younger brother of the king as king. That way, you know, he owes his position to you and he's going to be loyal to you, hopefully. But why does Rashi say that it's Hanun? And Rashi clearly thinks that this is the pshat. Rashi does not quote, you know, really far out Midrashim, especially in Sefer Shmuel. There's a reason he thinks that this isn't the Pshuto Shel Mikra. And if we just put a couple of pieces together, number one, most importantly, what's the man's name? What's the man's name, right? Is it a coincidence the man's name is Shovi? Shovi, which implies doing tshuva. Okay, so that's piece number one. It's kind of a funny name. Now, we could suggest that David maybe gave him the name. We see, you know, Nebuchadnezzar gives Tzidkiyo his name, right? That wasn't his original name. So that could be not. But that sounds like tshuva. And indeed, this new king of Nachash is doing tshuva. Now, talk about support from unexpected places. It's unexpected for the conquered king of Rabbah B'nai Ammon to send support to David. But it's also surprising and unexpected because Ammon and Moab, their trademark character trait is a failure to perform Hachnasas Orchim. A lack of chesed is definitional to Ammon and Moab. That's why we're not allowed to marry Ammon and Moab, right? It all goes back to Lot's original decision to go to Sodom and thinking that he could have his cake and eat it too, and Lot thinking that he could enjoy all the material benefits of Sodom while maintaining the Hachnasas Orchim. And where that ends is he ends up with neither. The consistent, both in the Pesukim and in Chazal, perspective of Ammon and Moab as the real forces of anti-chesed, the real heirs to the tradition of Sodom, as was exhibited by the king of Moab murdering David's family, as, maybe more importantly for our purposes, was exhibited by Hanun receiving the delegation and disgracing them, right, doubling down after Ammon and Moab refused to feed Bnei Yisrael. David sends guests, and instead, you know, they're sent back half naked. Well, now we would see this unbelievable tshuva. We have food and supplies being sent from Ammon to David Amel. Right. Also, note by the way, he's not called Ha'amoni. We have Barzilai Hagiladi. We had earlier Itai Hagiti. We had no problem throwing around people's titles of where they're from, but he is specifically not called Shovi ben Nachash Ha'amoni. And I wonder if that's a bit of a piece of that as well. And I think just one last piece about this. I think Chazal are sensitive to this. This is appropriate for us for Shavuos, because when we think of the chesed that comes, you know, Ammon and Moab, that's one of the reasons why Rus is such a big deal, right? What's happening in Rus is Bnei Yisrael have lost the chesed, and it comes from the most unexpected place. But the chesed comes, right, from Rus HaMoaviyah. But Chazal, for some reason, and it's really not clear why, often do not only talk of Rus HaMoaviyah, she is linked with Naama HaAmonis. And it's not so clear why. I mean, the Sukkim don't tell us anything about Naama. All they tell us is that she was the mother of Rechavim. And it's not even like Rechavim is such a great guy. So why are we so excited about Naama HaAmonis that she's put on the same level, right? That it was so important that we could have, it was worth everything for the survival of Lot just to have two people come from Lot, Rus HaMoaviyah and Naama. Rus is a whole book about Rus. Naama does nothing. But if we sense, you know, that there's this parallel chesed, really parallel to what happens with Rus, it's happening here with the father of Naama, that her father Hanun, who had been a dyed-in-the-wool, you know, totally inherited all the negative character traits of Ammon, but has put it all behind him with the chesed and the tshuva, and he is now shalom David. So I think we can understand some where Chazal are coming from with the importance of Naama HaAmonis as well. So you put it all together, and for sure, two out of the three people here, we're getting, you know, very surprising unity and support from David, or a place where we thought he wouldn't get it. His son has rebelled against him, his people have rebelled against him, his Shevet has rebelled against him, but now he's getting support from his former enemies. Okay, now we turn to Perek Yidchas, and immediately we have something very, very surprising. Let me just tell us this. So David counts the people. They set up an army with the captains of thousands and the captains of hundreds. I was like, well, hold on a second. Hundreds and thousands? David, where'd all these people come from? David, he had his ragged band leaving Yerushalayim with him. Where all of a sudden, we're organizing an army, hundreds and thousands and captains and generals, and David divides up the army into three groups, one group led by Yoav, one from Avishai, one from Itai Agiti. where did all of these people come from? So one suggestion that's made is that we may see here some of the consequences of Avshalom having assaulted David's Pilag Shim. Maybe we've seen some of the decline in political support for Avshalom as that deed spreads. Some of the modern Mepharshim suggest that harms the support for Avshalom and all of a sudden helps the recruiting for David. I mean, if people were supporting Avshalom in the first place, because this is going to be the new generation which is going to give justice, well, it doesn't really seem very just. The man is doing to his own father and his father's wives. That could be, but at least part of the story, if not the whole story, is that David seems to be getting support from a new area. The Navi is going to describe the army of Avshalom as the people of Yisrael. So it sounds like there is a distinct unit, a distinct place, which supports Avshalom. In Sefer Malachim, we know that Yisrael is going to be the shorthand for the 10 Shvatim, and Yehuda is going to be the shorthand for, you know, Yehuda and Binyamin, and also Sheva Shimon. But here, if Yisrael is going to be on the side of Avshalom, it follows to reason that where are all these people coming from? That's very simple. David's core support is coming from Aver HaYarden. It's the people on the other side of the Jordan River, the people far away from Yerushalayim. Those are going to be the people who are going to flock to the banner of David. You have Barzillai and Machir, who are some of the leaders coming with supplies. But the people are coming as well. And the simplest reason why they would come, I was happy to see, I think it was the Atlas of the Dat Mikra who made the suggestion. I was happy to see someone say it because it seems pretty clear. Why would these people, of all people, be so lined up with David? Remember, this was Ishbosheth's home base at the beginning of Shmuel Beis. Right? In the original civil war, we had Ishbosheth over here and David over here. And now all of a sudden it's flipped somehow. And we have David over here and Avshalom over here. Why are these people so dedicated in support for David? And the simple shot is that, you know, we can really draw an analogy to modern Israeli politics. All of the wars that David fought after he defeated the Plishtim, when he fought against Ammon and Moab and Edom and Aram Naharaim and Aram Tzova and the other various Arams, and he made a peace treaty with Geshur, those were all people who were attacking the people on Aver HaYarden. We know that one pasuk told us that Shaul also did battle with those groups, but it sounds like, you know, at best, it was successful defensive action. But these are the people who live on the frontier. These are the people who, you know, in Israeli politics, what's always the number one issue? National security. When you're living in that neighborhood, you don't have the luxury of having foreign policy be the 10th thing that people respond to when they care about the polls. You know, if you're living secure in the heartland of Eretz Yisrael, you have the luxury of being inspired and seduced by the charisma of Avshalom. If you are the hardcore, the people who've been living out on the frontier, the people who've been fighting for generations against all the different enemies around you, and David was the one who finally was able to unite the people and defeat every single one of the enemies that menaced you for generations, that's going to be a recognition and a hakara satov, which is going to last. So we have these people who had been Ishbosheth's people, but now they are fully on David's side because these are people who have hakara satov. These are people who appreciate what David has done for them, as opposed to everything we've seen until now, right? So we're seeing again and again the happier side, right? In these dark moments of civil war, we're seeing there is such a concept of gratitude, and a concept of unity, and a concept of recognition of what has happened in the past. So the army is now set up right under the three commanders. And then the people tell David something interesting. The people tell David, Yomra'am, lo seitze, right? So they tell David he's not going to go for it. You know, once again, we get a sense of David as not being totally in command over here, and the people are telling him what to do, or Yoav telling him what to do. But why don't the people want David to go out to fight? So they tell him, if they chase, if we run away, they're going to ignore us. And if half of us die, they won't care. You're worth 10,000 of us. I will suggest we see from here that the army was probably about 20,000 people, because they call David half of them. Half of them is equated to 10,000. You'll help us more from the city. So what exactly do they mean? Why don't they want David to fight? Why do they think that he'll be better off in the rear? Rashi quotes the Targum. Says the help David can provide is very simple. David will daven. He'll daven from the back. And as helpful as David can be as a fighter, you know, you think of Moshe Rabbeinu with Amalek, we'd rather David in the back davening. You do the tefillah. Let Yoav and Avishai handle the fighting. That could nicely explain the end of the pasuk, but it doesn't really explain the beginning of the pasuk, where they talk about why the people would ignore them if they retreated. What was going on over there? So Radak and a number of other Mefarshim explain that basically we need you. You are more important to us alive. That is an essential part of the battle. If we think back to the beginning of the David and Uriah Bathsheba story, so the original sin there, the Malbim pointed out very compellingly, was that David refused to join the army that was besieging Rabbah b'nei Ammon. Right? David lingered in Yerushalayim. Now, all of a sudden, the people are telling David, we want you to stay back. So we could wonder, what is the difference exactly? Why there was it bad for David to stay in Yerushalayim? But now the wise thing for him to do, what they want him to do, is to stay back in the city. And what we need to appreciate, what the people are probably driving at, is that there's a fundamentally different war going on over here. And the role of the Jewish king is very different. When David was fighting the wars of conquest and fighting against Ammon, so there the job of the king was to lead the people. Right? The people are fighting an enemy of Klal Yisrael, and the enemy threatens the nation. The job of the king is to lead the army, to remove the threat. However, here, what is the threat to Am Yisrael? The threat of Am Yisrael is not the enemy, per se. The threat to Am Yisrael is that they're going to lose David. Right? The threat is that Avshalom will replace David as king. When you have, it's one thing when you have the king, you have the succession set up, so the king is not supposed to stay behind. But in this war, there was exactly Achitophel's point to Avshalom. If Achitophel goes in and kills David, that's it. We're going to have Avshalom as king. And that is something which is totally unacceptable. So whatever advantage David could provide the people with his military leadership, it's completely undermined by the fact that in this situation, in this particular war, he is more valuable to them alive than dead. And so on the one hand, we see David's continuing tshuva. He wants to be at the head. He wants to be with the people. But at the same time, they're pointing out to him that this is not the same kind of fight we've fought before. And it's more important for you to be davening in the back and staying safe than for you to be here in the front. It's interesting. We'll get to this in a couple of weeks, but it sounds as a story in Shmuel Beis Parakhaf Aleph, which seems like it happened a long time ago when David was young, that David almost got killed fighting a battle against the Plishtim, and David's men told him he's no longer allowed in combat operations. And it sounds here like David really wants back in. You know, it's like I'm the fugitive again. We're in the same roads I was when I was young with running away against Shaul. It's just me and the old team, 600 men. You know, it's like David wants to really run the clock back. But the people are telling him, not this time. We have to see more guard. Okay, so that's the setup to the battle. So we have the army. We have David's position set. We understand why David is where he is. We understand where the army has come from. Now let's see what David's orders are and how the battle unfolds. So David tells Yoav and Avishai and everyone else, he says, go easy on Avshalom. And notice, and this is going to be, we'll really unpack this next week, but the Navi is going to be pretty critical of David over here. And one way that the Navi begins to hint that to us is all of a sudden the Navi says, "Vaitzav Hamelach Hasiyav Es Avishai Vasita Leimor La'at Lid Nenla'ar Avshalom." Right, deal gently with the lad Avshalom. The core problem we're going to have here is that it is David, the father, who wants to have mercy on Avshalom. But the problem is that the role of the king, the role of the melech, has to be to put the priority of the people first. And the priority of the people is going to be Avshalom has to die. Right? That is going to be the central tension between David's role as melech and David's role as father. And we can totally understand why, but it's going to be a challenge that he is going to fail. And Yoav is going to call him out for that as no one else can. Right? But we begin to just reference that carefully. The Navi is so strategic. So many times we've seen, so many times, when it calls David, David, and when it calls David the Melech. Right? It is the king who's saying, go easy on the Na'ar of Shalom. And that is not going to be appropriate. So Pasuk Vav, so we have the battle. Vayetze ha'am ha'sadeh likras Yisrael. You see, this is Yisrael, right? That's Avshalom's army is Yisrael, and David's army is the Am. And then we're told, Batia melchama b'ya'ar Ephraim. So the battle was in the forest of Ephraim. So just go back up to the map for a second, because we have to understand why this is difficult to understand why that could be the case. Here's Ya'ar Ephraim, right? The problem is that we're on the other side of the Jordan River. So we know the end of Sefer Bamidbar. Who lives on the other side of the Jordan River? 2.5 tribes, Reuven, Gad, and half of Menashe. We are in the territory of the half of Menashe. Ephraim is on the other side of the Jordan River, right? Ephraim, Har Ephraim, it's to the north. You have Yerushalayim over here. So you have Yehuda, right? And then the Torah says about Binyamin, Bank Seifab Shachain. So you have Binyamin in the middle. Binyamin is smack in between Yehuda and Ephraim. Ephraim is in the heartland over here, in the Shomron. So how could we call this place on the other side of the Jordan River Ya'ar Ephraim, the forest of Ephraim? They don't live over here. So Rashi quotes, and it's a Gemara at the end of the seventh paragraph of Bava Kamma, I believe, that this exact question. Mehechon hey, Ya'ar Ephraim, Ebra Yardin, Mizracha, the Ephraim don't live on the outside of the Jordan River. So it was given to Reuven, Gad, Menashe. So Rashi explains, Al mitoch shehisna Yehoshua, shiu merein bechorshin. He says, here's the deal. Remember, why did Reuven and Gad want the Ebra Hayardin? Because they wanted the pasture land. Well, where it says that they were not given a monopoly on the pasture of the other side of the Jordan River. And that the deal was that, yes, Reuven, Gad, half of Menashe, you're going to have Ebra Hayardin. However, you have to give some grazing rights to the other Shvatim. And this piece, Ya'ar Ephraim, right outside the Jordan River, right next to Ephraim's territory, that is the piece where that condition was fulfilled. So it is in the land of Menashe, yes, but it is a land where Ephraim was always welcome to graze, right? So once again, we are seeing another reference to unity in an otherwise disunified and civil war story, right? We see the history and we see it coming over here. Ephraim and Menashe, you know, we teach the kids Sefer Bereishis, they get along very well. When we learn Sefer Shoftim, all of a sudden Ephraim and Menashe almost have a civil war when Gidon is the Shofet, and then they do have a civil war when Yiftach is the Shofet. Yiftach is living in Menashe on the other side of the Jordan River, and they have a massive war against Ephraim. But now the Navi is reminding us, no, Ephraim has their land, has their place in the territory of Menashe. There is hope for brothers to get along. Now, back to the battle, it is not, if you have the larger army, you do not want to have a battle in the forest. So the Amnon Bazak suggests that we see here just the superior military strategy of Yoav and Avishai. They're able to set up the battle so that it happens in forest land where your numerical advantage is much more limited. Some of the other Mepharshim say, no, it wasn't the battle happened in the forest. The battle happened next to the forest. And then the people spread out. The people retreat. Either way, Navi tells us Yisrael loses, Avshalom's army loses, and 20,000 people die. Right. So it sounds like it's a catastrophe for Avshalom's side. It's clear that Hashem is behind this. I mean, if David's whole army is 20,000, then this is kind of shocking. It's reminiscent of last time we saw this was in Shmuel Aleph, when David fought against Amalek, and David fought Amalek with 400 men. And the Navi said that 400 men from Amalek escaped. Right, so here it seems like David goes to war with 20,000 men, and they impose 20,000 casualties. Then the Navi really, really hints to us, and the Farshim we're going to extract of this, that Hashem is involved in the battle over here, because the Navi says that as the other side, as Avshalom's army retreated into the forest, so we're told, Vayerev ha'ya'ar le'achol ba'am me'asher achla b'cher b'yomahu. The forest consumed more people from the end from Avshalom's army than David than were actually killed in the battle. Who exactly? What's going on here? So Rashi says it's the wild animals in the forest, you know, and all of a sudden they're attacking Avshalom's men. Kabbalah and Mepharshim say like the forest itself, you know, lots of fallen trees all of a sudden on Avshalom's men. But we can't help but think when we read this of, I probably will talk about this, but it's pretty clear. The Navi used the exact same language when describing Yehoshua's battle against the five kings in the south after the treaty with Givon, with the hailstones that fell. The Navi told us back then that Hashem sent the hail, and then Rabbim Asher Mesu Bavnei HaBarad Me'asher Hargu B'nei Yisrael B'charet. More were killed in the hail than were killed in the battle. And here the Navi is telling us the same thing. So that's already, you know, like our third reference to the conquest of Yehoshua in the last couple of Prakim. You know, David has been thrown out of Eretz Yisrael, but we understand the link to Yehoshua because David is coming back in. And it is a divinely assisted battle. Yehoshua had open miracles. Here there are no open miracles. It's all bitachon and hashkafa. But Hashem is clearly shaping the outcome of the battle here as well. Okay, so David has won, or Yoav has won. Avshalom's army has lost. Hashem has intervened in the battle. Biderech hateva. And now the focus shifts to Avshalom. So we're not going to get to all this, but we'll start and we'll pick up next time here at Hashem. So Navi says, Vayikarei Avshalom lifnei avdei David. Right, Avshalom happened to chance before the servants of David. Now, especially after the previous pasuk, where the Navi hinted to us that so many of only Avshalom's soldiers were being killed in the forest. Right now, we have another chance. You know, it's like reading Megillas Esther, isn't it? And a number of the Mepharshim. I just put the Ralbag here as an example. But I don't know what the Mepharshim say. Come on, Savav Hashem shenekra Avshalom levado. Right, Hashem arranged. Oh, it so happened that Avshalom by himself comes before the servants of David. And this goes back. This is one of the core pieces of Sefer Shmuel. When the people choose rule through human kings, so that meant there was going to be a change in how Hashem interacted with the world. That means we're not going to have the same open miracles anymore. However, Hashem's hashkacha, the derech hateva, is still going to be very much operational, just as Shmuel had said, you know, all those prakim ago. The hashkacha is still there. Then what happens? The very, very, very famous pasuk, Avshalom rochev ala pered, right? So he was riding on a mule. A mule is a classic royal animal, riding on a mule. That's a sign of royalty. Right, the mule runs under the large oak tree, v'chazak rosho ve'ela, and Avshalom's hair gets caught. Vayutan ben ha'shamayim ben ha'aretz, he's suspended between heaven and earth. V'peret asher tachtav avar. Okay, so the Mishnah in Sota already picks up on some of the clear symbolism here that Avshalom is caught by his hair. Right, so the Mishnah, this is in Sota because the Mishnah in Sota is talking about why the punishment for the Sota woman is particularly Mida Keneged Mida. And then in that context, you have this very interesting tangent from the Mishnah, very uncommon, where the Mishnah describes the Mida Keneged Mida phenomenon for a couple of other people as well. And first it talks about Shimshon who followed his eyes and therefore he was blinded. Okay. And then the Mishnah says, Avshalom nisga b'saro, l'fichach nitla b'saro. Since he took so much pride in his hair and his beauty, and he used that to help manipulate the people, so that's the clear symbolism of Avshalom being caught by his hair in the end. We could take this, you know, the imagery continues from just the hair, because it is specifically the royal mule. Right? Avshalom wants the royalty, and it is the royal mule that brings him to destruction. And then what happens? The mule gallops off, or whatever word for galloping you use for a mule. You know, at the end of the day, Avshalom's not the king, right? He's suspended, and the mule goes on. He's not going to be a real king. And there's one more piece as well, right? Where the Navi says that he is suspended bein hashamayim ubein haaretz. So the Gemara continues. And we'll have to unpack this a little bit more next time, because we'll see the sign of the Gemara, and we'll see what we have to unpack. So Gemara says, "Avar shakol safsira." So Avshalom, look, man's in a battle. So what does he have? He has a sword. So Avshalom is hanging from his hair, and the Gemara describes he takes a sword, balamifseke, and he wanted to cut his hair. Tanadvei Rabbi Shmuel, ba'usa sha nivka shaol mitachta. At that moment, the earth, right, the opened up underneath him, right, and he's going to fall into Gehenna if he cuts his hair. Rashi's going to quote this a little bit later, and we're going to, what this Gemara is going to raise, this idea of Avshalom refusing to retreat and accepting his punishment, which is what this Gemara is saying. We're going to have to ask whether there are any redeeming features for Avshalom in the end. Is Avshalom going to save himself? And we're going to see that's going to be a school in Chazal. There's going to be a school that wants to see a possibility of Geula for Avshalom. And we're going to see another school which really reads Avshalom the way we've read him until now, that he's, you know, rak ra min urav. He's had absolutely nothing good until now, nothing good going forward. But just one piece I want to take out of this Gemara is the Gemara is also, you know, there's one other time, of course, we've seen the phenomenon of the earth opening underneath someone, right? That's Korach. So Chazal are throwing a Korach image towards us, which makes sense because Avshalom is the Avshalom and Korach are the two classic rebels. We saw even their strategy in terms of how they manipulated and wild up the people was similar. So, you know, just for now, I just want to extract that piece that Chazal are seeing some Korach in Avshalom as well. Okay, so we'll look at a couple more psukim. We will not look at the death of Avshalom. We'll do that next week. But let's just take a few minutes to look at this interesting conversation between this Ish Echad and Yoav. Right. So Navi tells us there was a guy who sees Avshalom. So he tells Yoav that he sees Avshalom hanging, and then Yom Yoav the Ish Magidlo he never eats him. Ado lo akiso shamaris. He should have killed him on the spot. Would have given you 10 silver coins and a fancy girdle. It sounds, from Yoav's frustration, it sounds like Yoav had made this known. It sounds like it was public knowledge that Yoav had put a bounty on Avshalom's head. And that's why one of the soldiers tells him, I saw Avshalom hanging. Yoav said, well, why didn't you kill him? Right? A lie. I would have had to give you the money. It sounds from a lie that I would have had to. It sounds clear that Yoav has publicly put a bounty on Avshalom's head. Now, well, the person responds to Yoav, and he says, Yoav, you may put a bounty on his head, but I'd be crazy enough to take you up on it. You could give me 1,000 silver pieces below Ashlach Yadiel Ben HaMelech. I wouldn't have touched the son of the king. Why? We all heard you. When David commanded Yoav, Abishai, and Ittai, he did it in front of the whole army, saying, Shimru mi banar Avshalom, that no one should touch it, right? So we have Yoav who's given one public order. David gave another public order. And the man says to Yoav, I would not trust you. He says, the kol davar lo yichin min ha-melech, v'ata, he said, save me again. If I had done this, right, you would have backstabbed me. You would have stood on the side, and I would have been the one left holding the bag. Now, you know, Yoav is such a personality where you could, so many times you could look at him in two ways. I really think that in the whole Avshalom story, Yoav pretty consistently is the one that the Navi portrays as the one on the right. And next week we'll dig into this, but you know, the Kitzer, the catch 22 of Yoav is that his ability to be cruel and harsh can be very unfortunate and gives David a lot of headaches. But sometimes that's exactly what you need. And in this story with Avshalom, as Chazal would say, the mercy of David really is cruelty, really is Achzarius, while the firmness and the cruelty of Yoav ultimately really is mercy. So I'm inclined to read the next pasuk with Yoav, similarly to the way that that the Malbim and Abarbanel do. So Yoav says back to the man, he said, Lochin ochila lefanecha. And it's not clear what that means, ochila. That can have one of three different understandings. Ochila could mean, like, Vaychal Moshe espanei Hashem Elokav. I'm not going to plead with you. You know I'm done negotiating. That's one possibility, some of Harshim say. Another possibility is, I'm not going to wait for you. That's how the translates over here. I'm going to do this myself. The Malbim suggests that there's another one. It can mean lahaschil. It can mean to begin. Meaning what? What's Yoav going to say? Well, Yoav takes three spears and he sticks them into Avshalom's heart. And we'll pick up with this next time. But the way Abarbanel and the Malbim both say that Yoav tells the guy, you misunderstood me. You know, you thought that I was just going to use the army. You know, that's something Avshalom does. Avshalom uses other people to do his dirty work. You told me, you thought that Ata Hesyasev Bineged? He says, Lochin, Ochila Lefanecha. I will begin to kill Avshalom before you. I meant what I said. The man needs to die, and I am happy to do it myself, says the Malbim. Ani Aschila Hakoso. Binyan Shia Hachit Alai. I have no problem taking the responsibility and doing it myself. When I told the army to do it, that's because I realized Avshalom needs to die, right? It wasn't because I was trying to pass the blame. That's how the Malbim understands what Yoav is saying right over here. And the Abarbanel says something similar. Ein daiti kamo shechashavta. You misjudged me. Shetakeu ata v'ani asasev mineged. You thought that you would kill him and then I would stand on the side and leave you in trouble with David? No. Aviya behebech. Shani akeu v'ata tisasev mineged. I'm going to do it. I'll start. And you can stand on the side and watch. So Yoav is somebody who puts his money where his mouth is. And those two, Yoav and Avshalom, who, you know, we had the initial situation where Yoav brought Avshalom back, but then Avshalom had the resentment towards Yoav. I think the way that Abarbanel and the Malbim are reading the Pesukim over here, it highlights the contrast between these two leaders, right? We have Avshalom, who is someone who manipulates and uses others to do his dirty work. And then we have Yoav, who's being suspected of doing the exact same thing, but he's saying, no, I meant what I said, right? And I am willing to take the risk. And we're going to see he's going to do a whole lot more than that next week. Yoav really is going to be the hero of this whole thing. Okay, so, all right, we'll leave off here with Yoav beginning to kill Avshalom, and then we'll come back next week for the death of Avshalom, what Yoav is going to do, how David is going to react, and how Yoav is going to react to David's reaction. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody. Have a great Yom Tov.
Shabbat Shalom.